What's going on, guys? It's UAP Gerb, and thank you so much for joining me for this in-person interview with UMC vet and Arrow whistleblower Michael Herrera. Before we get into this interview, there's just a couple things I want to touch on. I co-hosted this interview with my good friend Joey Is Not My Name. Many of you will remember him from my first video on Michael or have seen him around Reddit and Twitter as one of the first people to really start investigating Michael's claims of his experience in 2009 in Indonesia seriously. When we sat down to conduct this interview, we sought to really ask some of the lesser asked questions and lesser known details of Michael's encounter in 09 and his claims of meeting a black program insider. So we do kind of expect you to be somewhat familiar with Michael's story, at least know the base details of his 09 experience and his follow-up claims. If you haven't, I highly recommend checking out my original video on Michael that I did with Joey, or watch his Sean Ryan Show podcast appearance. Both are fantastic videos. I highly recommend checking them out if you're not too familiar with Michael's story. If you'll remember back to my Marines and UFOs video, you'll recall this is the first time I ever covered Michael's story, and I was super dismissive of him, super skeptical. That's why after all these months of talking to Joey, talking to Michael, sharing meals with Michael, hosting Joey, and conducting this interview, I'm super excited to revisit this case, as it's one I've been privately investigating on my own for quite a while. So without further ado, please enjoy this interview with Joey Is Not My Name and Michael Herrera. So you guys get to the top of the hill, and of course, this is when you observe this object. Which part of your team first observed this?
It had to have been, it wasn't me, it was somebody else. And they were more pointing like, what is that?
And so this was a big misconception for me at first. Joey had to kind of help me visualize this, as I'm sure it was for a lot of other people too. You guys only saw a top triangular section and some lights of this.
Not really lights. Lights didn't happen until the thing actually took off. But you can see, I mean, if you're trying to think that these are two trees, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like where you can see the top part of it, but then you see the other part, but you can't make out the whole size of it, right? Because you have trees and everything distorting it. So really only we saw was something changing colors off in this little thing that I had visual on, and you see it moving around. And it's like, it's not a building. I mean, we thought it was a building at a point, but I mean, it's just off in the distance right there, and it's changing colors. And something that you have green vegetation sticks out like a sore thumb. It's easier to say if it was a building because, I mean, you'd expect kind of buildings to be in that area, but this area didn't have any of those buildings. Didn't have anything like that.
So who made the decision to kind of go forward and check this out?
It wasn't me. And it was the person in charge. And that's who was the one that did that.
As you approach the object, you could only still see just above the tree line, the top of the object.
You could see the whole thing. When we got down that hill, and it was something we weren't allowed to do, obviously, because mm-hmm. you're not supposed to abandon your whatever your post
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. Can you describe what was going on at the LZ at the time where you guys decided, I mean, to make this decision, this risky decision,
right,
to go and check out whatever this was?
So I don't remember much going on at the LZ. I just remember taking video of that helicopter that was off in the distance. It wasn't like it was super close.
Did you guys feel like that helicopter was like part of your responsibility to guard, or was it like
we had assumed that there probably was other people there, or probably other Marines on board that they were probably dropping off in that area? That would be my assumption. I don't remember thinking anything like that back then, you know, 14, 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine, you know, whatever you guys saw.
Well, it's something that it was abnormal. And you know, yeah, curiosity is a good thing to an extent, but I tell people all the time, curiosity is what kills a cat. And it's something in this way that it changed our lives.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a light decision.
It wasn't a
risky decision, and you guys made the choice. And
I mean, we didn't even rack around in the chamber. It's just like we weren't expecting to really get into anything like that. You know, it was just walking down, trying to see what that is. And then if it wasn't nothing, we're just going to go back up the hill and resume to what we were doing, and obviously it led to what we experienced.
When you're walking, you know, you guys are at the top of the hill, the decision is made to go check this thing out, and at the top of the hill, you don't actually see any people, you didn't see the trucks yet,
nope.
You're just seeing the top of the craft. So you guys go down. The moment of interception with these guys, can you describe? I think what gets lost on a lot of people is how fast it happened, and how quickly they took control of the situation. I mean, what was your first impression when you saw these guys?
Well, I heard people yelling at us. That's what got my attention. And when we saw weapons in their hands pointed at us, you're not going to move. You're not going to raise your weapon up, because obviously that's the point. And then obviously, and during the briefing, I had touched on in numerous interviews that there was a possible SEAL team that was out there trying to handle things that if they were tasked on. What they were specifically doing, I don't know. But I remember in the wardroom that that's what they were talking about, having some sort of element of U.S. Navy SEALs there. And for a second, we thought it may have been them, and we're just like, oh, shit, here's these guys. You know, they don't. Then obviously we were going to talk or something, or
right,
just go.
And like everything would be cool. And
these guys were not. These guys were not carrying themselves as SEALs, and they didn't have anything identifying on them. And obviously they were screaming at us, telling us to put our weapons, you know, put our hands up in the air, because we had slings on our stuff, right? So that's when we're putting our hands up in the air, and every single one of us did the same thing. It's not like we're. I mean, how are we going to raise a weapon that doesn't even have a full chamber? What are you going to do at that point? If you even rack that round in, try to bring it up, they've already got their muzzles pointed at you. It's almost like a police officer coming up to your vehicle when they do a traffic stop and they feel threatened, or they may have an indication that your vehicle matches the description of somebody who has had a gun pointed at them, for example, where they would believe that it's reasonable suspicion for them to deploy their firearm. Are you going to move suddenly and make him think you're going to reach for something and he just blasts you? No.
And how did these men approach you, in a tactical column, a pincer?
We were the one that was in a tactical column. They had, so if I was looking at this and we kind of started, and that's when we naturally kind of spread out like walking towards them. And that's when they basically had four guys on this side and they have four guys on this side. And I talked to numerous special operators about this type of tactic, and they call it a nosebleed, which is where they have basically interlocking fields of fire with this direction on one target. It's a very rookie, easy thing to do. And these guys, they already had that position. So it tells me that maybe there could have been more operators that were around that area, maybe on the other side of the craft, on the other side of where the trucks may have went off, which I didn't see them go off anywhere. But from what I've been told, there was more than just those guys there. So if we would have gotten into any kind of conflict, we were severely outnumbered already.
At what point did the craft become fully visible?
When we got to the bottom of the hill and we walked a little bit forward and it started to clear out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when this thing was just sitting there.
And then the men approached you right after.
Correct.
You noticed it?
As soon as we broke that threshold of mm-hmm. getting into that clearing is where they basically had us intercepted. It's not like we could run behind anything, because you can't.
Right.
And the trees weren't like big red oak trees where you could hide behind. I remember the trees probably being as big as this water bottle, at least how thick. Probably a little bit thicker, but that's not enough to stop anything.
Yeah, of course.
It's not enough to hide behind and not get hit, you know? So it's not, you know, everybody has the whole, they think they're John Wick until they're in that situation, but it's like, I would like to see anybody else in that situation to see what they would have done. Because knowing what type of operators we encountered, now that I've already been through all of this, been briefed on it, been included to an extent, none of us would have been a match for those guys.
Yeah.
And so what did these men do as they trained their rifles on you as they approach you?
So we heard, they were pointed, they were screaming at us. You could actually hear them flip everything off safe, and because it's an audible click. And where we were at, obviously, there's not a lot of noise coming from the hill, obviously, because everything that's going on over there is basically silent because you have a hill blocking everything. And then the craft's not emitting any kind of noise except for that little hum or that guitar amp. I mean, it's not exactly like a guitar amp or like a transformer, but it's something similar to that. You actually replicated pretty good to
yeah,
an extent.
Right.
So, and that wasn't as audible compared to when everything started to go on, and when, you know, when they had us, you know, because we weren't at the where we just broke that threshold, right? We actually pulled up a little bit more as they were telling us to. And so they had their weapons on every single one of us. And there was only six of us. There was eight of them, which means that it's easy for them just to, I mean, I don't even know if their weapons are full auto, and they probably could be. Ours are not. They're only three round burst or semi-automatic, and most of the time they teach us to shoot in a semi-automatic, you know, one round per person. a kill shot at least. So, I mean, it's not a headshot. I mean, you have a T-box and what you're training for combat marksmanship, but these guys could have full automatic M4s. I wouldn't have ruled it out, you know, which means that they just need to, each person doing a couple round bursts, 3 to 5 round bursts, I mean, it's going to get everybody where we were at.
Now, one thing that people bring up is, you know, you had your camera. At the top of the hill, you actually got some pictures of what you guys were seeing.
I remember at least a couple photographs, but I remember a video.
Video as well, that's right.
I remember a video, and that's when I had a dump pouch, which all of us did have a dump pouch.
Yeah.
But I had it right here all the time, and that's where we basically put expended magazines because you're not going to drop them because you have to reuse them.
Right.
So, and it also helped, too, if you had carry extra ammo because if you had some malfunction, or sometimes we use the saws with because my had regular saw drum pouches on my stuff where I could put a drum here and a drum here, and then I had grenade pouches up here. And most of the time I would just put magazines in whatever the easiest side to reach was. And that's basically what I had. So we didn't have like M4 or M16 pouches. I had saw drum pouches where I had all the mags in, which we had a combat load. I had 6 mags.
They disarmed you, right?
Yes.
That was kind of their first, like once they approached you, you've described how they were very methodical and how they did that.
They wanted to gain control of the situation, which they had that control, right? But they're going to sleep better because they took our weapons from us and slung them, and going through making sure that we had our magazines out. It wasn't like they were spending us like some law enforcement officer checking you, tracking around your ankles, anything like that.
Right.
They're not doing that. The only thing that they searched us with was our military IDs where they knew they were at, which is what my suspicion was, that these guys were former military at some point because they knew exactly where our IDs were.
And you said they interacted with your IDs with something that what we would recognize today as a modern day smartphone.
Yeah, so they had something that I refer to as a BAT system that we were trained on, which is like a biometrics and tracking system. It could be the acronym for it, but I just remember saying BATS. And they tried that first. So they put that away and they had these things. I mean, it wasn't like, because iPhones were kind of bulky back in the day, and they had Blackberries, and I had a Sony Ericsson MP3 phone that was pretty bulky. And they had something that was really thin, and that's what they were using. So it could have been something that was comparable, but I don't know.
So while you're getting searched, the craft is in the background. For anybody that hasn't heard you describe this craft, can you tell us what it looks like?
So I remember it because there was corners, which means to me it was an octagonal shape.
Actually, would you mind drawing it for us?
Let's see, I got pens over here.
I like that idea.
That would be cool. And you know what? I'm going to move. All right, so what did this craft look like?
Okay, so and this is going from our point of view, right, that I can remember. So I'm just going to say this is like vegetation, right? And this is to represent that clearing. What I remember is kind of like a pyramid shape at the top like this, because I remember seeing some shading, and some were kind of brighter than others, like this. Then I remember it going like this, and then it had corners, right? This may be looking a little bit strange, but this is just a rough draft. Used to be a better artist back in the day. And I remember seeing these vents, at least that's what it looks like, on each of the corners like this. There's a vent here, and it was like it was positioned on the lines, like this. And then on each corner, when this thing took off, it had lights that would pop on, which would have been like red, yellow, green, and blue are the only ones I remember. And it kind of had a line that went like this, and it had some sort of scale pattern that it, you know, I estimate is octagonal, but it could be, it could honestly be circular, it could be square. I wasn't close enough to depict it. But and this is where, this was the blackest, darkest thing that I have ever seen in my life. It's almost like light got absorbed into this, and I don't know if this is just because of the craft. It may help with the function. But I know there's probably third graders or something that say they can probably do a better job than this, and I'd probably agree with them. So
now what about the platform?
The platform underneath was kind of like it was raised like this, not off the ground, but just like an incline, and then went underneath like this, and it was around the same kind of Length is a Craft, and it had kind of some points on it as well, which, you know, obviously it fits under the Craft when we saw that happen. And it wasn't like where we were at. I would say this is approximate, even the same distance as it was. There was not like there was any lights or materials on here that I remember seeing. But then you have, I'm going to draw stick figures. So I'm just going to draw them black because these are black team guys. I know this is not a Van Gogh or a Mona Lisa drawer, but I'm just trying to gather everybody's attention to see how what I can recall as this and all these guys. And we were essentially in this area kind of online 4, 5, 6, right? And we weren't like evenly spaced out, but you guys can kind of see how there's 6 of us, there's 8 of them, they've got good field of view, we can see this going on in the background. And I'm gonna draw a line through this, but basically where the directions where the trucks came from were from our left. So they're coming up and then they would go like this. I don't remember seeing them go off the platform and going somewhere else. I just remember them going on here, but then we're also facing the fact that we're dealing with these guys at the same time. So our focus is going back and forth. One, you don't see anything that looks like that ever. Two, you're not in a situation where that happens either. So as I wish there was more details that I can remember aside from that, but that is what I briefly recall as far as what the Craft looked like, besides changing colors from a light matte gray to a dark matte black, the whole thing.
And so before this Craft took off, what did this platform do?
So this Craft kind of sunk down a little bit like this. This platform itself raised up.
And there were trucks and other crates?
I don't remember seeing the trucks in there. They could have been because where we were at, and mind you, I didn't see it as it started going up. I saw it when we were going back and forth, and the only thing that got my attention, and I'm sure got everybody else's attention, and I'm only speaking from my point of view, was the only thing that got my attention was something was moving. And because your eyes are used to, it tracks movement, right? It's just something that gets your attention. So when I saw that raising up, it was already what I'd estimate over our, if we're only 5'10" to 6 feet tall, it was probably almost 10 feet off the ground.
Did it raise rapidly or in kind of a slow motion?
Not super rapid. It was enough to kind of be slow, but still enough to where you could catch it. But I don't remember seeing any kind of containers going up with it or trucks or nothing. I just remember seeing the front profile, the truck with a trailer behind it, and that's what I was able to see, that cylinder in front of that container.
Let's get another piece of paper and draw the trucks.
Okay.
And actually, I want to show you this too.
That drawing is going to be worth a lot of money someday.
Keep it.
Here, let me do this.
Oh, get the signature. Cool. This is probably my favorite part of the interview. You drawing this stuff? It's awesome.
Yeah, I feel like I'm in kindergarten right now.
Showing off your colors.
That you recognize.
But it's cool because it helps you kind of describe as you're doing it, you know. All right. Trucks.
All right. So what are these trucks, the containers with them? Could you describe those?
Yeah. So, like I said, I only saw it from certain profiles. And what I remember distinctly with these, I don't remember seeing like a Ford logo or nothing, like a Chevy Duramax on the hood or nothing like that. We're kind of far away in comparison to that. So I'm going to draw 3 different views or profiles, which I remember seeing these trucks. So the first one's going to be as if it was coming towards us. So there's going to be like a headlight here. There's like a grill, right? Bumper, and it had like a, I remember having like kind of like a hitch is what I'm assuming, and then there's another headlight here. Again, I'm going to apologize ahead of time that this isn't going to be, I remember seeing.
Now, when you say you didn't see logos, like you didn't see Ford or Chevy?
Yeah, I didn't see nothing like that.
Stated what kind of trucks they were, though.
Yeah, like that's
you
my
recognize the body style.
Yeah, and I would say that they're Ford F-350s.
Yeah,
is what I would assume they were.
You're saying the insignia was.
Yeah, they took. Yep.
Gotcha.
What I do recall seeing is I had like these things on the sides here, It's kind of like vents, but they're not really vents. And it's kind of reminding me of what they had on military Hummers for night vision. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what they had on there, which tells me that they run these at nighttime as well. And these were like big, aggressive off-road tires, right? Mm-hmm. Truck bed, okay. You can kind of see these cases, which are Pelican cases on the back.
And what are Pelican cases for anybody who doesn't know?
I mean, it's a brand, but these are weapons. Where did we? I mean, because we had the same ones that we transport weapons with. Mm-hmm. And that's just.
Do they carry small arms, munitions?
Yeah, okay. Stuff like that. So then this was hooked to a trailer that had four wheels like this. Okay. Trailer. And the only thing I remember seeing of this container, it had the ridges kind of like a shipping container, but not much. It had the cylinder that's kind of on the front right here.
So I wanted to show you this. Let me just throw this right in front of that so that camera gets it. What do you think of that?
Looks identical, but then again,
now the other thing.
So I remember seeing it having four or two tires on each side,
so
right?
So dual axle.
Yep.
So this was another thing I found where they actually have the Connex box on top of it.
With more aggressive tires, but this looks shockingly familiar.
Because that's like the type of, I mean, that's a shipping crate, you know. I think this is called a Tricon configuration. So right. They're all standardized, like the sizes and stuff.
And these were outfit. They had these cylinders on the front right here that would I, you know, come to find out it's actually oxygen supply. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So draw those cylinders.
Okay. So I'm going to black it out completely because the cylinder itself was black and that's why.
And initially when you saw this, you hypothesized this might be humidity control for something
for drugs,
like drugs.
Right. That's what I testified to Arrow with because I didn't think it was people. That wasn't in my thought process at the time.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about Arrow in a little bit. But so you testified to Arrow before you did the NPC in June of 2023. Okay.
Yep. That was I had testified last year to Arrow. It was late April.
Okay. Late April 2023.
Yep. All right. So that's kind of the view that.
Dude, that's really good.
So. And then obviously the side view.
So cylinders basically spanning the whole width of the container.
Correct. It wasn't like a small one.
Large.
It's the whole width. Correct. All right. So here's where the tires would be from the side profile of that trailer. Of course, there was no white wheels. It was all black. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing kind of the back. Okay, and then this container right here. This is a cylinder from a side view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Truck bed right here.
How many trucks total do you remember seeing?
Four.
Four. And did each one also have weapons crates or just...
Yes, removed? Each one of them had these, what you would call Pelican cases.
I mean, okay.
But just weapons cases is what they definitely look like.
Were the cases opened, closed?
Closed.
Okay.
And the windows, I remember being kind of dark, so...
Could you recall any other operators or people in the trucks besides just the drivers?
I remember one truck that went on the platform and all the door, at least some of the doors open, but I can't recall.
Were there any people standing on the platforms? Or,
no.
Okay.
I don't remember. But I don't remember seeing people on the platforms. So that is kind of, and these are black, of course, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a side view of what that is, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Which, I mean, obviously these were black. The shipping container was black, everything like that. The other profile I'm going to draw is going to be from the rear.
Did each truck have a shipping container attached to it? Okay.
So here's a container right here. Remember seeing the bars.
Hatch doors on the back.
Yep, like this. Okay, can't really see the cylinder at this point, but I'll just indicate it being there.
You'd also said that they were up armored. What did you mean by that?
They looked a little beefier, thicker material. You know what I mean? Like they look like they'd be bullet resistant.
Okay.
Because they look. I mean, you can see a regular truck, and it kind of like, okay, it's a regular truck, but these look like they were reinforced.
Kind of like a Secret Service car.
Yeah, to an extent. Okay. But, all right. So there's a container like that, which we're not elevated, but this is just to put perspective of the truck and just so how we were seeing it from the back.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only views that I remember seeing these trucks.
Because you were in front of the craft and they kind of came out in a little bit of a circle.
Side like this and then went up that direction.
Okay.
And it wasn't like they went straight. They were going up to that platform.
Okay, so you see the craft. You're basically getting weapons checked, weapons stripped from this team. What happens then?
So they're going through each of us, taking our stuff. They take our magazines out of our pouches and they kick them off. They got one guy off in the distance that I remember was a standoff distance, like more than 10 feet. So obviously we tried to run and grab our stuff, and he's just going to light us up if he wanted to.
Did he have a different rifle platform to the main guys?
No.
So same loadout.
They all had the same stuff. Yeah, they had the same kind of – I mean, they may have different attachments, but I remember most of the part seeing ACOGs on each one of them with the PEC 16 illuminators on those. Those are what I remember seeing.
One thing I've always been curious about – Did you notice any of them talking on the radio to someone?
One guy had a radio, and I don't remember him talking to anybody. I just remember seeing it and with the antenna coming up that he had pressed to his vest. But he was the main guy that was kind of telling people what to do.
Yeah.
And he was mainly the one besides another guy that was yelling shit at us, like, we'll fucking kill you. You know, it's easy to get lost out here, et cetera.
Did it seem like, you know, when they intercepted you guys, obviously there were other guys in the trucks doing their thing. Did you have the impression that, like, all of a sudden they were like, oh shit, we need to wrap this up and get out? Or were they kind of just not really even caring about what was
going on? I don't think they were kind of caring. They may have not even saw what was going on. They could have. I mean,
yeah, well,
I don't know. That's speculation at this point.
Yeah, clearly we're getting into speculation there. But yeah, it's like, I also think about the fact that this, you know, the earthquake. You know, the whole reason this operation was there was because there was an earthquake on, it was the end of, or the 1st of September or end of October?
It was the end of September and then to, I think it was September 30th, if I'm not mistaken. Don't quote me on that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's correct. So, and then, you know, the Denver shows up on the 9th. So we're, you know, 9-10 days after the initial earthquake. And, you know, just, you know, obviously speculation here, but it's like, it kind of seems weird that why would this operation be occurring 9 days after the earthquake? You know, of course, afterwards you've kind of been told like what that operation was all about,
right?
And, you know, recruiting people in disaster struck areas. But who's to say that was like, maybe they had been conducting those same operations all week long.
They could have been. And believe me, those are some questions I've asked some of these gentlemen that I'm working with, and they, you know, they don't know because everything's compartmentalized. I'm hoping one day maybe one of them that I come across does know, because I'm going to ask him a lot of questions. Yeah. Because, I mean, just like anybody listening or watching to this, or anybody who's wants this to come out and come forward, I'm 100% with them. I want this to come full circle just like anybody else. I'm just as impatient. The only difference that separates me from anybody else is the experience, but also having knowledge of what's going on to an extent, at least with what I've been exposed to. I just have a little bit more information.
So you get to the point, you know, they're threatening you, they give you your weapons back and tell you to go, you know, back up the hill, don't look back. When you get to the top of the hill, what do you see happening at the LZ?
I just remember, I mean, because I remember once we broke the top and all of a sudden I remember seeing some of our guys just start running. So I'm following suit with them, right? Because if anything's going to happen to us, it's going to get the attention of everybody else. And I remember seeing some people, but it wasn't like it was like close up. I just remember when we ran back, we had our weapons strapped to our back that were very tight, uncomfortably tight, right? Because it's compressing your vest. And I remember having a gash on my right part of my neck because we had like a yoke or like a collar on our vest. And I remember that when they put that through that it actually kind of, the slings we had weren't the best quality and they're not soft. They're plastic and polymer, whatever it is, or cloth, whatever material they make out of them. And it's very hard, so it kind of cuts you up a little bit. And then I remember us getting back there, and I remember seeing a couple people off in the distance as far as some villagers or whoever the civilians were, and there was some other military personnel. I don't remember them being Marines. I don't remember what – they may have been the Indonesian military could have been there, but they were still off kind of at a distance compared to where we were at. And there was this gunnery sergeant that was there, and I've never seen this guy before. I don't know if he was attached to the ship. I don't know if he was brought by any other means. I have never seen this guy before.
Now, gunnery sergeant, you know, you recognize it because you see his rank, right?
Correct.
Now, gunnery sergeant, that rank is specific to the Marines, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay, so when you speculate that maybe he was assigned to the ship or attached to the ship, I think you kind of mm-hmm. say, what do you mean by that? Like, how
so
would that work?
They, each ship, if they're... From my understanding, I don't know 100%, but from my understanding, there are some ships that have like a combat loading group or somebody who's basically loading Marine stuff onto a ship. I don't know the specific, I can't remember what it's called. They also have some Marines that are red patches. They have a red patch on their cover, and then they have red patches on some of their, I think on their blouse, they have some on their shoulder pocket and some on their cargo pockets. And this guy didn't have those, that I can recall anyway. He may have, he may not have, I don't remember. But I remember his rank because obviously it was a little hard to see it because woodlands have black shapes and sometimes it distorts that. And if you end up calling somebody by the wrong rank, you get to pay for it with push-ups or get screamed at, right? So, which honestly, if I was in that position, I would have screamed at people and tried to fuck with them too for getting my rank wrong. So it happens. But
when you ran back to the LZ, you were running towards a helicopter?
No.
Okay.
The helicopter was not there yet.
Okay, so
he had a radio that he was talking with.
Okay.
And he was communicating with whatever the pilots or whoever it was. So what happened when we got there, he kind of like, first of all, for security, why do we have our weapons slung on our back? That's out of place. No Marine's going to have that going on. And that's what I think he was mainly more upset with was because that we were supposed to be our weapons proper, no magazines in, you know, which obviously they put our stuff in, but they put it into where it'd be very inconvenient to try to load it up and then go deal with it. So I think that thinking back to that, I think that that's mainly why he was upset was because, okay, well, you guys look fucked up is mainly what his... What I would assume, right? I'm just speculating at that point. But I remember us stepping off to the side, off in the distance a little bit, and we're basically squaring ourselves up. We're taking our weapons off and off of each other, giving it to us, putting a magazine in, and having to resume the normal carry.
And so this gunnery sergeant is standing just in the clearing where the LZ, where you guys were dropped off.
Correct.
Was he surrounded by a platoon of Marines, or was it just this gunnery
sergeant?
Just
him.
And other people off in the distance.
Other people off in the distance. So they may have linked up, and then he probably told them to go away or whatever he was doing. I have no clue.
And then because he was on the radio, that's when CH-53 came in and picked everybody up. Now, on the CH-53, did you recognize the pilot? Was this the same helicopter that dropped you off?
I don't recall any of that. I just remember seeing a CH-53, and that's when it landed, and we just boarded up on that thing. I don't remember. I mean, obviously, our point of view, I don't remember looking at a pilot. I never had a chance to, and it's the same thing with this. I don't know specifically who was flying or what.
And so nobody said to the gunnery sergeant what you guys just experienced?
No.
Okay.
So you came to the LZ. You got off the helicopter. That helicopter left. You go to the top. At a certain point, a second helicopter comes at a different location.
Correct.
Drops off supplies?
Yes.
Was that the that had a cargo net? Thing,
yes, it
right?
did. Because yep. I took pictures and video of that coming
so
in.
So that helicopter is dropping that net, and that's when you crest the hill. Yeah, you know, kind of at some point there, you crest the hill to go investigate the craft.
Yep.
You come back, that helicopter's now gone.
What I'm assuming is it dropped the cargo off, and then they may have landed and let people out. But by the time,
by the time you came back,
there was no helicopter that was there.
Okay.
Nope.
That helicopter was gone, but then there was obviously the supplies that they had dropped off.
Off at the distance.
So do you remember seeing what was happening with any of that? Like, were there people? I
remember seeing people over there, and it could have been supplies. But they were off at a good distance.
And so where the gunnery sergeant was he near some supplies too?
If I can recall, there could have been some boxes or something he was messing with that was there. There may have been boxes. I don't really recall.
Is there a chance that like he didn't even know you guys were there and he was kind of like.
Could have been the case.
What the hell is you got? Like, where are you guys coming from? What's going on?
It could have been a case. I mean, like I said, I really don't know.
Yeah.
It's speculation. But I just remember seeing a gunnery sergeant there who's like, you guys look fucked up. And, he was yelling at us for that reason. So.
And so from that period of time to when you left the LZ, you were basically just doing what? Just like hanging around waiting for the helicopter to show up?
Yep, and we were just kind of walking around, by ourselves, of course, trying to make it look like we have we're securing the area.
Okay, so you kind of resume that role of
security. Even though through our heads we're going like, what the fuck just happened, guys?
Were you guys discussing this amongst yourselves, or was everybody pretty stone cold?
We were stone cold. Nobody wanted to talk about
that. Was there any point that you guys discussed it with each
other? When we got in town to Subic Bay, only question I had asked one of them was, are you going to say anything about this or tell your wife? And he goes, absolutely not. And that's literally it.
And have you encouraged these fellow Marines you were with to come forward and tell their story too?
No.
Okay.
They're not happy with me for obvious reasons. I don't blame them. This wasn't something that, I tried to get one of them to help me with this to an extent. And his response, which everybody has seen publicly, was kind of the indicator that something did happen, that something was wrong.
And that's for people who don't know the text that was featured in the Daily Mail article.
Correct.
That basically says, leave me out of this.
That was when I had members of the Senate Intelligence Committee asking me to have some, and to message one of them that I was still in contact with, seeing if he could tell anything anonymously to them, which they already know who he is. I've already provided everybody the names to these guys among the Pentagon, Arrow, they all have that.
Do you know if they've been contacted by Senate Intelligence Committee or any
not
of these?
Not that I'm aware, because okay. I'm pretty sure I would have gotten probably yelled at or fuck you or something.
Yeah.
So you guys get picked up by the CH-53 Super Stallion, returned to the USS Denver.
Correct.
How long, what would you say the time elapsed was from the second you were in the chow hall approached by the major to returning to the ship?
Well, we didn't get approached by the major when there was in the chow hall. There was other Marines, other people. I don't remember specifically how that happened.
So who called
the
volunteers?
She wasn't gathering everybody up. These were higher up. It could have been staff sergeants or sergeants or something that says, hey, you guys want to come with this? Or, so whoever was at that point, you're going to meet in the wardroom at this time. And I don't remember the specifics of the time. I don't remember who told us. It's so long ago.
Yeah, but it's just helpful to kind of understand.
Right, and
the
it wasn't anybody in my typical chain of command, which was, because obviously they were kind of more the, hey, you guys are needed for this.
And these were just mission volunteers, not hand-selected, like strong operatives or anything like that?
No, they were just randomly put us in sticks.
Okay.
That's all I remember them kind of organizing. You're in this stick, you guys are in this stick. So it wasn't like it was something that was very well planned or they based off your skill set or what chain of command or whatever this was.
Yeah, so like I think we can kind of go chronologically through like your experience in Indonesia. So like the first thing I'm wondering is like what did a typical day look like for you on the Denver?
On the ship?
Yeah, like when you were like en route to Indonesia, like I know you were assigned to the officer's chow, but like what would kind of a typical day look like for you, just like on the ship?
So typically, if I can recall this accurately, because every day blends together in this.
Yeah, plus it was like 15 years ago
correct.
At this point.
So, you typically would have reveille, everybody would get up, but obviously we'd get up early because we were either helping with breakfast and having to serve up that and at least, which It's not like we were just serving food, because we didn't do that. We were just more, I think, trying to set stuff up, try to clean stuff, you know. So the cooks actually took actual good care of their job because they're working for the officers, which is great. So yeah, they want to take pride in what they do. We got to eat really good because of it compared to what the other guys got to eat. So that was always good. So
breakfast. Was it kind of like a full-time job? Like that assignment was kind of like,
correct,
you would report for doing officer's chow, and it was like an 8-hour shift type of thing?
Yep.
Or was it, okay.
And sometimes they'd cut you like with a break, so you could either go, which I went to the gym on ship, or I went back and then slept for a bit or whatever it is. So there's always things that you can do, because when they task you to work onto that, that's where you're spending your time.
Yeah.
So me and
so I, how does it work with, you know, especially for me, because like I don't have any, you know, military experience. You know, you have like a chain of command that you're a part of, mm-hmm, you know, as a Marine, but I know there's, you know, when you're on the ship, you've described kind of like, it's like a separate chain of command or like,
correct, because what, who you're reporting to are like the Marines that are in charge of that part of the Marines, mm-hmm, that are on the ship with the logistics.
Yeah.
All they basically did was say, hey, your number's been picked. You're going to go over here while you're on ship, which is great.
Yeah.
Cause like I said, we got to have fun doing it. We got to eat better than everybody else. You know, so it was something that I enjoyed doing, because I got to eat tuna all the time. I got peanut butter. I got all the good stuff. We got T-bone steaks. Everybody else got the little tiny cuts, and we got full T-bones.
Yeah.
So you would work in chow with people that weren't necessarily in your immediate team or platoon, just random people on the ship whose numbers were called for same duty.
Yep. I mean, it wasn't really a number basis. They just selected whoever, whatever amount they needed, they've all told us to, you know, this is what you're going to do. And typically during that, I do remember deploying, at least being forward deployed to Japan a couple weeks to, I think, a month before the whole main element did, because they got us ready and we went on ship before everybody else did too, because we're obviously working this detail. So they have to kind of read you up on things, show you how to do things. And then when the whole thing kicks off, get on ship, and everybody's just, you know. So for weeks we were on ship with nobody else in our berthing, which was cool too.
Yeah.
So they were trying to assign, figure out where Marines were being assigned to, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so when you got, you know, you spoke about getting briefed in the wardroom, that that was where you were assigned. So how did that exactly go down? Like, were you like in the middle of, you know, working in the kitchen, and then you just heard someone call out like, you know, hey, we need some volunteers? Was it?
I think it was that. I don't remember that part specifically.
Yeah.
I just remember the key things. I remember who briefed us, which was a female major. And then they were putting up pictures of Obama when he was a kid, saying there was family members were there. So the things that really stuck out of place are kind of what I remember mostly.
Now, did you, you had actually brought this up earlier. Had you ever seen that woman before?
No.
Like,
was she dressed in Navy, USAF blue?
She was in, she was in our MARPAT Woodlands.
Okay, so USMC, okay. Yep. And the other people who were kind of brought to volunteer with you, were they in the mess hall with you when the major comes in and is requesting volunteers?
Yes, some of them.
Okay.
Not all of them, but some of them.
And so at this time, like your immediate squad, team leader, the other people you're with, they're doing other duties on the
correct
ship.
They're doing with whatever the unit's doing,
okay,
typically. So that's how that works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we weren't in a combat situation, so that's why that it was a little bit different, because it's more relaxed. Now, if this was something that was combat-oriented, then they really wouldn't pull us off to do anything like this, because we'd be training and doing whatever we had to do with our unit.
Right, because I know there's a lot of questions about like team leaders and so forth. So when you're on an active mission with a team leader, you'd be with them like glue, but on ships, you're assigned to your actual duties
correct
and so forth.
And it also kind of depends on what details you're doing, obviously.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's not like that for everybody. There's people, you have an acting team leader who's just a guy who fills that billet.
Mm-hmm.
He could be somebody else that's not, in our instance, was not in our platoon or squad or anything like that.
So, like, what kind of typical, like, check-in would you have to do with any superior while on the ship? Or
so
was it kind of...
When we would report to that, they'd obviously kind of take roll call, make sure everybody was there, and then that's pretty much it.
Okay.
It wasn't, I mean, because really it's not like rocket science, for example.
Yeah.
So, You know, but it was, you also reported to Navy personnel too, because they're the ones that you're typically helping and assisting.
They're part of the ship.
Correct.
Right.
So mm-hmm. they have more kind of what you would call a higher billet at that point because it's their ship.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because that's really helpful just from someone who's not, you know, military. That provides a lot of context. Now, so during the actual briefing that you were given about the mission that you were about to partake on, were there other people in the wardroom during that briefing, or was it so like there could potentially be bystanders that kind of overheard, you know, the mission briefing essentially?
So anybody who was in there were some key leaders, but there was also some other NCOs. There were a lot of people I didn't know.
So some I'm just thinking Marines. You know, could potentially be witnesses that would have, you know, seen you, seen the briefing. And
if they remember.
Yeah.
I mean, right. You know, I mean, like I said, I don't remember anybody else besides some of the guys, but I just remember the thing that stuck out was a female major because she was beautiful.
Yeah.
So I'm like, that's, you know, of course you're on ship. You're like, man, I see a lot of women around.
Yeah.
So there was that. And then obviously the whole thing with Obama, mm-hmm. you really don't see anything like that. It's not something you're really briefed on most of the
right.
time.
So I wanted to show this to you. Does this look like what that war room would look like? I was trying to find a picture of like the actual Denver.
Yeah, that would.
That is a different ship, but it's the same, you know, the same class.
Yeah, from what I can recall, because they had a wall where the projector was hitting, and that's where they were getting, but that's kind of similar, at least from this view.
Yeah.
I mean, but then again, it looks a lot like other wardrooms that were on other ships
well,
that I've been
just
on.
To get a general idea of the size, like, cause yep. like for me, thinking like cafeteria, because a wardroom is essentially a cafeteria.
Yeah,
it's just
but
like a
smaller
fancy
because obviously.
For the officers.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. So it's kind of a more small,
yeah.
Intimate kind of setting.
Correct.
What else can you remember from this briefing? What was the mission operation directive? What was the mission time?
I don't remember any of those fine mm-hmm. details, just because one, it's been a long time,
mm-hmm.
but two, the only things I can recall is literally the female major briefing us and then pictures of Obama when he was a kid, his parents, just stuff that really stuck out.
Yeah, and I actually found evidence of, you know, Obama, he spent a lot of time in Indonesia mm-hmm. when he was a child, and that's
yep.
all public knowledge, so... it's interesting that they had included that. But I mean, like, just overall, like, in general, what was your understanding of, like, what you guys were about to go
into? Security.
Security.
Okay. Security.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it was more...
Because there was a delivery of supplies.
Yep.
You're going to go to a remote village. You know, there's plenty of evidence that says that the,
right.
the heavy lift helicopters, the Super Stallions on the Denver, were specifically going to be tasked to go to remote villages because... You know, roads were being blocked off by landslides and stuff. And so you're saying security for
the LZ.
Delivering the...
Yep.
Yeah, delivering
I mean,
the
because what the whole point, and this isn't something that just even what that female major was saying,
yeah.
but it's just even the fact that everybody knows that this is the second largest terrorist capital in the world. It's a very Muslim-dominant area, you know what I mean? So there's people that typically aren't going to be very friendly of us, mm-hmm. and that's kind of the first concerns they were having. Why they did things the way they did, I don't know. I didn't plan it. I wasn't in charge with that. So there's things that even I have questions or it's like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
And what was the protocol after the briefing? Were you immediately ordered to go to a armory locker, check out weapons and ammunition, mm-hmm. and report to the Super Stallions?
So all they told us to do was basically get... So they got all our stuff and... we went to the armory to draw, and they already had weapons picked for us
mm-hmm.
because I was a saw gunner.
Yeah.
So we're not using a saw for this type of ordeal,
yeah.
you know, because it's not, you're going, not going into combat. So that's how I remember because I was a saw gunner. I never really was issued an M16. When I got there, I was actually issued a 203 with an M16A4, and that was with Gulf Company. And they said that the reason why they wanted me to do that was because I was the boot and they're looking for the people with the grenade launcher because they know it's a team leader. So meaning that the enemy's going to target you. So, which I mean, it was cool because I'm like, I get to carry a grenade launcher. But then I like the saw because it's a belt fed automatic weapon
mm-hmm.
and that I like that better. And so naturally being used to an M16, it sucked because I like having a machine gun.
Yeah.
Full auto.
Yeah.
Know.
And I, so, you know, the whole idea of you providing security, you know, and initially a lot of people would say like, oh, that's baloney. Like no one would have weapons on a humanitarian mission. Cause really the overall operation was humanitarian relief, delivering supplies, and people are like, oh, you would never have weapons. But I found Rear Admiral Richard Landolt, who's the Rear Admiral who debriefed you after your mission on the ship. He actually did a sort of like a press conference briefing, and I'll just read a part of the quote here. So once the 53s came aboard on the morning of the 9th of October, we put them to work, first getting survey teams out to the countryside to see where would be the best locations to drop the cargo that we wanted to get there, and also to get people in place, because when these helicopters start showing up with cargo, the first concern is crowd control. You know, so you don't want people, you know, rushing the helicopters. And another little interesting thing that kind of supports this that I found was photographs from the 9th and the 10th of the Indonesian military, because, you know, there was also Indonesian military doing relief as well. And there's a picture of a helicopter and a whole bunch of locals just like all over the helicopter, just like mobbing it. Totally makes sense that, you know, there would be, you know, a mission like that to provide security. And not to mention, we've, you know, at this point have found numerous photographs of people, of Marines doing exactly that. They had rifles and were, you know, providing security around the helicopters.
Right. Well, I mean, security is needed. It's just common sense at that point. You know, as much as people would say in the military, or at least in the Marine Corps, common sense is not a common virtue, but you still got to protect and have a barrier between everybody else, because second largest terrorist capital in the world, there's also desperate people who are desperate to do anything for help. And you have that combination of things that can get pretty tricky. Thankfully, we didn't have that, but thankfully, I would have rather have experienced that compared to what we did experience.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Now, do you remember which day you did your mission?
I don't recall specifically the day. That's kind of what I'm having trouble with. I don't know if it was the 9th or the 10th.
So the ship arrived. So there's a little bit of discrepancy on the exact date. And I think it comes down to the time zone of like whatever press organization reported it. But like, for instance, right in this testimony from the Rear Admiral, you know, he says the 9th. So it seems like it was like early morning on the 9th or like late at night on the 8th. So was it like, do you remember it being the very first day that the ship arrived?
Oh, well, so, I mean, we never really went topside.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, we're in the kitchen or
in
the wardroom or anything like that working. So I don't remember specifically where. The only thing I remember is them turning the phones off, because they had these phone banks that you have on ship, and they turn it off for about a couple weeks. And because I was going to call my dad and be like, hey, we're here, you know, but they didn't want that. So I don't remember specifically the day. I do remember that when we were on foot, that it was had to have been somewhere in the early afternoon or probably late morning, that time frame. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure. I can't recall that. I wish I could, because then I can kind of pinpoint where things may have, we can coordinate it somehow.
At what point did you realize that you weren't going to have radios?
I wasn't a radio guy, so that wasn't my thing.
So like, wasn't even on your radar to like think, oh, do we have radios?
Yeah, because I'm not used to that. I mean, they trained us on the radios, but it wasn't something that we ever really had. I mean, I wasn't a team leader or a squad leader at that point, you know, so I didn't have access to that, and that wasn't a concern. My concern was just what I was dealing with.
Yeah.
So I don't remember radios, you know, and the fact is I don't remember seeing anybody have radios. And the thing is it's a humanitarian mission. It's not a combat operation, you know, so it's not like you're stepping out expecting to get into firefights and things like that.
Yeah.
Just humanitarian.
So when you guys were gearing up for the mission, you just thought whoever the designated kind of squad or team leader for this operation would have
something like that, okay. Correct.
And I think there's been a lot of confusion about these points. So this mission happened during one of your designated shifts in the chow hall with a team that was not your designated team leader. Okay.
Correct. Somebody acting as a team leader, you know, so which happens, you know, in situations like this. At least this is my experience. Mm-hmm. I can't speak for everybody else, but just with what I personally dealt with, this is how it went for us.
Now, going back to the rifles, you know, like I said, at this point, I found so much evidence that there were definitely Marines there with rifles. However, there were a lot of photographs of guys basically just providing labor, you know, moving boxes, loading helicopters, things like that. And one thing that was interesting that I learned from multiple platoon members that I had reached out to and spoke to, they told me that there was like this rumor that some of the first Marines that flew in had rifles and they got like chewed out by like an Air Force colonel and were told to like go back to the ship because it was like bad optics. And I'm curious, did you ever hear that rumor?
I don't remember ever seeing an Air Force colonel.
Yeah.
I don't remember seeing an Air Force lieutenant colonel, which everybody knows about that. So, but as far as an Air Force colonel, I don't understand how an Air Force colonel would have jurisdiction over that kind of operation anyway.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be in a role to tell Marines that they have to go back to a ship. That's somebody else.
Yeah, I found that odd as well, but I didn't know, you know, not knowing
anything about it. I could understand a Navy Fulbert captain or a Marine colonel for that matter. He would have the authority to say something like that, because what you're talking about is the money and the resources to get X amount of people from ship to shore. So it's going to cost money. It's just going to not make sense at that point. So
you got on the helicopter, you flew to Tobing Airport, which it's not named that anymore, but you said that you never got off the helicopter at
Nope.
the airport. It was basically just, you know.
We landed, and that's what I remember too, and this is kind of what I was able to provide people because we never got off.
Right.
And I can know that basically the direction of when we were flying off the ship, that they could see the ocean and they can start to see the land. So it kind of tells you somewhat the direction of where you're heading. All I remember from the airport that we landed on was that there was blue roofs.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can indicate out of that.
What I'm getting at is it's perfectly plausible if you guys, you know, didn't get off the helicopters, it's perfectly plausible you could have landed there and not caused any sort of stir by walking around with rifles because you didn't get off the helicopter.
Yeah, because I remember that too, because we were sleeping,
yeah.
some of us,
yeah.
on the helicopter, because that's what you do, you
right.
know, you get used to
yeah.
getting transport everywhere. We did in 7 tons, AAVs, helicopters, all that fun stuff. So you're just like, oh, I'm just getting a ride, and you can fall asleep anywhere at this point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and it's boring. You know, it's not like it's anything. It's all just humanitarian. You know, we're hoping at that point that there would have been something, but not in the indication of what we experienced, but, you know,
right.
something outside of that. So when we, because what I do remember vaguely is when we landed on the airstrip, and I remember seeing other helicopters basically trailing behind us and land. And then we were sitting there. I don't remember the time or how long we were sitting there, but I remember then us taking off.
Do you know what kind of helicopters those were? Were they also?
It's 53s.
Okay.
There may have been some 46s too. I'm not entirely sure, but I only remember the Denver, and I only remember being on a CH-53. I don't remember any kind of other helicopters that were on that deck.
Yeah.
I never really spent much time topside.
The only reason I bring that up is, I'm wondering if those were the same helicopters that ended up following you guys to the LZ, you know, because I know you had said that there were other helicopters, because
that could be plausible.
As far
yes.
as I know, the Super Stallions were only the ones that came on the Denver. Like, there weren't any additional Super Stallions.
Yeah, I don't remember, you know, I don't remember any of that.
Right.
I mean, there's been plenty of ships that I've been on where I remember seeing 46s,
mm-hmm.
Which are the dual, the egg beaters, if you will.
Right.
I remember seeing plenty of those, you know, but as far as the Denver, I don't really recall that. Could have been, it could have not been.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't know.
Even if your mission happened after the point where those guys supposedly got yelled at for bringing rifles, like, it's plausible that you could have had your mission even after that point and just slip by unnoticed because you didn't get off the helicopter.
Right.
You know? So the flight to the LZ, describe the view that you have outside the back of the helicopter.
So coming from the airport, I can remember just looking at the ocean, and then we were getting, I remember seeing some very heavy vegetation and kind of like hills. It wasn't like flat with trees or bushes or anything. It was like getting thicker, and was I remember seeing some hills, not from the helicopter, but because when you get off the bird, they have one area where you can't go because you have this big tail rotor and you don't want to run underneath the thing. So they always say either, I think it's go to the right or the left. I can't remember. But whatever side the tail rotor is not on is where you're egressing the helicopter. And then basically you would form a 360 around the helicopter to provide that security, and then it'd take off. And then you basically would get into formation and you'd patrol on from there. I don't really recall when I got off the helicopter or what I really saw at that point. But I do remember seeing some hills, and I remember seeing some thick vegetation. I don't remember if I saw any villagers or other personnel or people there.
Backing up just a step, like when you guys were at the airport, were there any supplies loaded on the helicopter? So this was strictly a personnel transport.
Correct.
And were there any other people on the helicopter that were being taken to the LZ, or was it just
It was just U6? Us, and then you have the crew chief, and you have, you know, some other crew support, and then the pilots, obviously.
I only
recall one crew chief who was just basically walking up and down, watching everybody doing their job. I don't remember anybody else. I just remember just one guy. And I don't remember seeing any kind of boxes or stuff that they would store in there. And obviously we didn't have anything on the bottom, because how are you going to land at the airport when you have underneath?
Yeah, if you like a cargo hook type of thing, which some of the helicopters were transporting stuff that way. So you landed at the LZ. You describe it as a hasty LZ.
Yep.
Now, I've come to learn that's like a technical term. That means something very specific. Are you using it in that way, or what does that mean for someone who like
hasty
doesn't
know? Is kind of like off the hip. It's not something very thought out. It's just like, okay, where can we? Okay, right there looks good, right? And that's maybe what they were thinking as far as the pilots are concerned. I don't know, but maybe they had it designated. But it just seemed to me, because we were kind of the first ones there, that it'd be hasty in my opinion. But then when everything else is set up, some other Marines that probably come in were like, okay, this is secured. It's something set up. It may not be a hasty LZ at that point. But when we approached it, I just remember not really seeing anybody there. So it's kind of like, okay, well.
So there was no, there wasn't anyone at the LZ when you landed.
I don't recall that. There could have been some bystanders off in the distance that maybe saw the attention or saw what was going on that decided to come up at a later point. But yeah, as far as arriving there, I don't remember seeing anybody.
So you guys step off the CH-53. Your primary objective is to provide security.
Correct.
What do you guys do right when you step off the helicopter?
Well, we saw this opportunity to take the slope because we have visual around everything. It allows us to basically act within that protocol, right? As being an tactical advantage of being in an elevated position is where you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, you know, I wasn't the one that made the decision. The guy that was in charge of us was the one that made that decision. You know, it wasn't terribly too far in comparison, but at the same point, when you have visual of that and you're also watching some other stuff happen, I remember only seeing one helicopter that actually had the cargo net on the bottom that was flown in, dropped it off, and then it banked off to the right.
What I'm curious is, like, what was your initial impression when you got off the helicopter, like, in comparison to your briefing? Like your expectations that were set by the briefing and then the reality of you getting off this helicopter and you're there. First of all, you said the helicopter left, right?
Yep.
Like it dropped you guys off. It's gone. You guys have no radio.
Correct.
There's really no one around. You guys are the only people there. So like, can you remember, like, was there an adjustment to your expectations of like the reality of the situation versus what you were expecting?
Honestly, I thought it was more like, hey, we're not doing shit with this.
Yeah. You know,
it's like, it's just going to be boring, just standing around looking at people, like, you know. And that's why I had a video camera and I was taking pictures and video, because I remember getting the one helicopter that dropped off something on video, and I remember getting it. And needless to say, it wasn't at the point where we, you know, because we were conditioned 3 with our weapons. It wasn't like it was chambered around or nothing. We just had a magazine inserted. Safety was on. The bolt was all the way forward. Weapon was on safe. And the ejection port cover was closed, as it states in the condition rules, right? So I thought it was just, oh, yeah, we're just going to be standing around. This is just going to be kind of boring. You know, even trying to help out with boxes or something probably would have been more helpful in comparison here, because you're actually doing something.
Yeah, right.
So, you know.
That lines up perfect. Like, every single person I've talked to who was on this operation, you know, doing different missions on the operation, described the same situation where they felt it was like boring. It was like an excuse to get off the ship.
Yep.
You know, obviously you're doing a good deed and you know, it's a good experience from that perspective, but it's interesting to hear that because I think a lot of people have this misconception that this was like, you know, because you had mentioned that, oh, you know, you were notified there were terrorists in the location, that you guys were like super on alert. Like this was like, you were ready to engage an enemy and you know, that sort of thing.
Nothing like that.
Right. Were you surprised when the helicopter took off?
Yeah.
Okay. And did you have any sort of estimated time frame when it was to return or the mission duration?
I have no clue about that.
You guys, or I suppose the squad leader decided that you guys should go up to the top of the hill, right?
And you know what? It makes sense because we were out in the open, and you don't necessarily want to be out in the open if you've got no support at that end.
Yeah.
So where we were at was kind of hidden, and you kind of get in the vegetation a little bit more. So I can kind of understand why he would say to, let's go ahead and push up this direction.
Now, you've mentioned a second helicopter flying in. You had your camera. You know, you took some pictures of that helicopter coming in. But did you, I almost remember you saying that it didn't fly to the same landing point that your helicopter did. It landed somewhere
off
different.
In the distance, yeah, a little bit further away.
So that makes me wonder kind of how big was the LZ essentially? Like it was kind of just like an open area. It wasn't just like an enclosed.
No, it was pretty open. I remember it kind of being open, but that's where I remember the hills and stuff because there was like an open area with thick, tall grass, right? And it was kind of, I would assume, muddy because it's a tropical terrain, obviously. It wasn't like we were on a dirt road or something that was already, you know, cleared out to be used as transportation. So I think it was just more in a sense that there's a clear area over here. And obviously there was, the second helicopter probably saw other people that were probably close to that area and assumed that those are the people. For us, we were off in the distance. So whether or not he could see us at that point, I don't know. I assume he wouldn't be able to, but because where we were at, I mean, there's trees, you know. Mm.
Yeah, so you didn't see any sort of like preparation to the LZ?
No.
Like they didn't cut down trees ahead of time. You didn't see any red tape. Because I've seen some photographs of other LZs that, you know, showed like red tape kind of closing off the area.
And yeah, I don't remember any red tape or seeing that kind of stuff. So.
Right.
So what would you estimate the time elapsed was from the second you left the chow hall to returning to the Denver?
Had to have been a couple hours.
Okay.
Had to have been a couple hours.
But not like a full day?
No, it was not a full day. It had to have been a couple hours. It was nothing.
Something that could have taken place within the span of a chow hall shift. Like the time you'd
probably
spend working
in the chow. Probably more than that, too, could have been, you know, because it had to be a couple hours, man. You know, it wasn't like an all-day thing.
Okay.
Thankfully.
You know what I forgot to ask is what was the weather like at the LZ?
Sunny.
Yeah.
Yep. Sunny. I remember because it was hot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was hot regardless of, I guess, if there was cloud cover, it still would be hot because it's tropical. I don't remember actually looking up at the sky to see if there were clouds or if it was sunny. I just remember it being hot, assuming it was sunny.
And so when you get back to the Denver, how does it work? Like, you know, you have your rifle, you have to like go back to the armory.
Correct.
Or something?
We dropped everything off there, gave them the magazines. It wasn't my magazines, it was somebody else's.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there was the armor that gave us those magazines that were full.
Because you were Saul, so you had your own weapon assigned.
Yep, I had my own magazines, but actually I don't even remember if I actually had those on my vest too or if I would have left them locked up or... I typically had those in my assault pack, which I didn't bring an assault pack with me. I'm trying to think, remember. Yeah, it was somebody else's magazines, it sure as hell wasn't mine.
Because this was a loaner M16, loaner magazines from assigned to a different soldier.
Correct.
People compare you to like the Doty and Benowitz story, and I'm like, that's completely different because Benowitz didn't have this like a undeniable experience where he saw an anti-aircraft.
Yes, correct.
He had radio communications.
Yeah, he had
that was
radio communications, and he speculated that it could be ET, and Doty just egged that on.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, this is totally different.
And this is coming from Doty himself. I asked him kind of what that whole thing was.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, well, somebody said they heard something, Paul, and this is what I was told to do.
Right.
That's what he said.
So, I mean, like, it just logically makes no sense. Like, if you were making this up, if a disinfo agent were to come and, like, be like, yeah, I know about your operation that you stumbled upon. Yeah. Well, it's like, if you made it up, you would know that he's lying.
Well, exactly.
Because how could he tell you that he knows an operation
exactly.
if it was made up? Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
No. And I mean, I wish it was made up, because then I wouldn't have to have been going through losing my fucking hair and having the, you know, sleepless nights, and literally just I wouldn't be in the uncomfortable position I would be in.
Yeah.
And it's not fun being in this position. It really isn't. That's why I tell people, especially, I'm not encouraging my guys to come forward. And let's say if this thing blows open and all of a sudden everything is able to be proven true, that, and let's just say these insiders at some point ever do, or some information comes out that's physical, that literally no shit can prove everything, then maybe they would, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it put them in a different position. But right now, I mean, even for myself, they know that I'm uncomfortable. And they kind of like, well, it's your fucking fault. I don't blame them. I mean, but if I didn't see what I saw and somebody else from a different perspective was telling this story, I don't know how I would react to that. I probably wouldn't believe it. I'd probably be, you know, but that's the only thing is, before any of this happened, I was not somebody who believed in this shit. Mm-hmm. I was somebody who was like, okay, well, this guy's out of his fucking mind, or, you know. Well, let me guess, you're in Mississippi and you're fishing and you saw a fucking craft and you saw fucking grays. Okay. What episode of X-Files are you talking about? Yeah. That's how I would think of it. Mm-hmm. But then having my experience, it's just like, if I experience this, okay, maybe there might be some validity to what they're saying. I don't know. I wasn't there. But I know, based off of being in my shoes, it's like, it's hard to say somebody else is not true or try to point out the flaws or anything like that. I know what it's like to be in somebody's shoes like that. Granted, I didn't see ETs. I saw operators, and I saw it was clearly man-made, and it was didn't do shit a normal helicopter or plane did. I can tell you that.
Right. I mean, it's like an unmistakable 100%. Experience. Like, it's 100%. Not like something you saw at a distance that was like, nope. Oh, that looks weird. Like, this thing's right here.
Yep.
You see it. It's huge.
We're close enough to hear it.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
That's kind
and
of the point.
And you saw it fly off.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like,
didn't have a rotor. It wasn't like a helicopter. It wasn't a plane.
Yeah.
And no rotor wash on the vegetation.
Nothing. Nothing like that. It was like, it was isolated in itself. Like, it didn't disturb any of the environment. Is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. And I wanted to be a fighter pilot, and I knew pretty much what kind of aircraft we had at our disposal as a Marine Corps, and especially the Air Force only has a certain amount of planes they're using. Helicopters, same thing. There's only so many. This obviously wasn't Indonesian military equipment. I don't remember anybody coming saying, hey, yeah, Indonesian military has something this sophisticated, or Chinese or Japanese or for that matter.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I find it interesting too, you know, you testified to Aero, and like I noticed in the historical report, you know, they emphasized like belief and like, you know, basically trying to say, you know, people might believe what they saw or anything, but we can't prove that they're lying. And I'm like, what you're describing is an unmistakable testimony. It's not like you could say like, oh, well, maybe he believes that's what he saw, but maybe it was something different.
I know,
like,
what
no
I saw.
There's no way it was,
right.
You know, some
I mean,
normal
if
thing.
Anybody was to have seen this, they would remember this for the rest of their life.
Exactly.
It's so distinct because this never happens.
Right.
It's stumble. I mean, in some ways, people think, oh, I stumbled on the gold. No, it's really not. But in some cases of saying that, yes, we have this technology, because there's human involvement, obviously. It's not like there's an ETs in there flying in this damn thing, and there's just operators who just choose to be there. I mean, it's completely man-made. And with the human involvement, it just tells me, okay, well, man-made, human involvement means it's some group has it. Yeah. Now I know who it is to an extent.
And speaking of Aero, I really wanted to kind of fast forward to when you talked to him in April of 2023. What was that like?
Well, like an interrogation to an extent.
And so you spoke directly to Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, right?
He's the only one that I can confirm that, yes, I talked to. Mm-hmm. I know the other gentleman, but what I signed stating that I was not allowed to divulge where we met at or who was also there, But Dr. Kirkpatrick was in the interview, and I think he was in everybody's interview. I'll have to ask other whistleblowers I personally know if he was sitting in there with them, but he was there.
What was his demeanor like when you were speaking to him?
Not really interested. Everybody else was taking notes. He was more interested in the fact of, because he only asked three questions, and the three questions were all the same. It was, who were these operators? Mm-hmm. I already stated once, I don't know. I'm not going to know the second time. I'm not going to know the third time. I know a little bit now of who, what group they're a part of and what their backgrounds may be, but I don't know who they directly are. And if it was any of the people that I've been talking and working with, I would remember who they are based off their faces, and none of them are those guys.
When you testified to him, did Dr. Kirkpatrick say he'd follow up? Did he say what was going to happen next?
Oh, we'll follow up on it. You know, they wanted, because I had asked them if they could get the satellite imagery of that day, and they said they had access to that. It's been more than a year, and they have yet to have anybody contact me from Aero saying that, yes, we have the imagery. Where can you point out? Because, I mean, compared to 14, 15 years ago, it's going to look different. Maybe they expanded the city. There's things that vegetation have grown. There's any numerous things that could have happened between at that point to now.
And how did you feel when the historical report volume one came out? That was a complete misprint lie of your testimony.
Correct.
Stating you saw an extraterrestrial vehicle.
I didn't say extraterrestrial, and I didn't say they were U.S. Special Forces. None of that came out of my mouth.
And you got to think that that's a purposeful omission to say those things, because that's blatantly false.
Correct. I've stated in every single interview, and even in National Press Club, and even with some gentleman that I'm still in touch with who was in the skiff with me, he, for one, knows I never said anything like that because he was sitting right here when I was talking to Kirkpatrick, among others. So I was pretty upset at the fact, but you can't really be upset because you already kind of expected them to do something like this. I mean, that's just what they do.
Was there, because I think some of the people who testified to Aero, there was a written memorandum for record of their testimony. Do you know if there was any written record of what
you told
them?
I don't remember that either. I remember them taking notes and handwriting everything, trying to get the
details.
But
I think it was something that, like, the witness had would sign. You know, they would read over, like, okay, yeah, this is what my testimony, and they would sign it for record to be like, this is my testimony that I provided to Aero.
I signed several documents. That could have been one of them. I don't recall that. I remember signing a non-disclosure saying that I would not talk about who specifically was there besides Dr. K already admitting that he was in our interviews. So that's easy. The other gentleman, I can't. And then the location, I can't talk about that. That's legal binding because it's not anything illegal. So I have to respect that.
Yeah. What other memorandums have you seen for the Aero? Because I've only seen Eric Tabers, who, of course, is a second-hand kind of commenter.
Well, I think there was something that was a FOIA release from the Black Vault that I had recognized was
what I provided you, right?
A direct, it was the same exact form that you had shown me.
Yep.
So I had recognized that.
And that was provided for me to look over before
making that
trip.
It wasn't like the actual one you signed, but it was kind of to review.
Yeah, because there were screenshots of this gentleman's cell phone that he sent me who's involved with that.
Did you watch his interviews with Stephen Greenstreet? It'll just piss you off.
I don't watch any of his shit, dude, because I just know it's all bull fucking lies.
There was supposed to be a second piece that completely got moved. And
you know what would get people's views if they, hey, Sean, go ahead and come on to this podcast. Here's the whistleblowers. Hey, buddy, how's it going? I haven't seen you in a while. Thanks for being a fucking dick.
He would never. He said he wouldn't.
Because he knows. Because guess what? I can contradict the shit that he's talking about. So can other people.
He said he wouldn't do any more media appearances after getting caught at a 2018 Skinwalker Ranch briefing. He lied that he wasn't at.
Well, Brandon actually had posted that, I think, because he did the same thing. I didn't talk to him about this. I wasn't at this meeting.
And then Brandon just posted the picture on Twitter.
Go. I remember I hit Brandon up at that point.
Yeah, one thing I actually kind of find funny is, you know, so Nathan came forward, you know, your team leader claims that, you know, you're making this all up. You know, first of all, it's like, so he was on Vetted with Patrick, and it was framed as if he was in a position, like there's no situation where Nathan would have seen the UFO because nope. from your testimony, he wasn't part of your squad.
No, he was not.
That was there.
Nope.
So he wouldn't have seen the UFO, right?
Not at all.
Yeah. So for him to be like, yeah, we were on this mission, but we didn't see the UFO, it doesn't make sense because whatever mission he did, obviously he didn't see the UFO.
And that wasn't on the same one.
And you weren't on, exactly.
Nor was this a secret night mission.
No, it was not.
Nor, and it did not involve aliens.
Not at all. I never spoke seeing ETs, guys. That's kind of why this is boring in comparison to other people's stuff. You know, but no, it was not a night mission. That would have sucked to have been our night. We didn't have night vision with us, you know. I had my Kevlar, and I didn't even have a Rhino mount to mount anything because I always kept that off because it just get in the way during the daytime. And typically I had, on my Kevlar, I usually had goggles that were clear lenses.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time it's just easy to pop those off and put them on just because, you know, I didn't like having darks because it just really fucked with my vision and just, I hated it. And not only that, but these were ESS and they fogged up like you wouldn't believe. So at least clears are easier to deal with that as opposed to the dark lenses.
Mm.
But yeah, Nathan wasn't with me.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I find kind of funny, like when you think about it, you know, if you know, he's saying you made this all up. And so if that's the case, it means not only did you decide to make up a story about UFOs, but you decided the actual mission I went on with Nathan, I'm going to pretend that didn't happen too, which makes no sense whatsoever. And I mean, really, the only thing that makes Nathan's testimony have any weight whatsoever is simply the fact that you're denying that you were ever on a mission with him. Because you could have very easily have just said, yeah, I did two missions. I did one with him and I had this other
one. I didn't do two missions.
So it's like, it's just like anyone with half a brain would like know that, you know, if you were making this all up, just say, yeah, well, I went on this real mission with Nathan too.
Well, yeah, it could have easily said something like that if that was really the case. And if I wanted to lie about shit.
Right, right.
But, you know, then obviously the insiders wouldn't exist and you know.
Well, that's the biggest thing for me is like, why would this insider be approaching you?
And it's just not one guy, it's multiple, right. You know what I mean? So why would they spend any time to try to help me if I was lying to anybody? Why would they expose themselves and their parts of it in details that I personally know? They wouldn't take that chance. Mm-hmm. Their butts already puckered up just like mine compared because obviously what they're having to deal with personally. They wouldn't subject themselves to going to somebody who's lying. Doesn't make any sense.
But so Nathan, the thing that's most compelling about Nathan is you know, he is who he says he is.
Correct.
You know, he was your team leader.
At one point, yes.
And he was on that operation. He was on the ship. All of that stuff logically lines up. And he has this photograph of two people on a helicopter. He says one of them is you. You deny that. You say
correct.
That's not
I know your... who it is. I'm not going to say who it is, but I know who it is.
Yeah. So the thing that's interesting though is someone found a match in the camouflage between that photo and another photo of you.
Is it the Daily Mail photo?
Yeah.
Okay. Because there's only two photos that I know that have been released. One of them was when I sent to Josh Bosworth with Daily Mail because they're like, "Hey, do you have any pictures you wanna?"
Yeah.
I believe it's you, helmet on, holding the saw.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
So yes, and I mean, but here's the thing: it's a medium reg that I was wearing. A lot of them are the same patterns of that way. It's not like it's a fingerprint of one specific thing.
I mean, it's odd that it's in the same location. Like, I know, like, some of the patterns repeat, and that you can find examples of this all over, of finding, like, the pattern, you know, on a leg here and then on a different uniform. Like, it'll be on, like, the other leg or whatever.
Right, but it's, like, some of the patterns don't even look identical, just in my opinion. You know, that's just where we're at. And
so you don't think there's any possibility that, like, It was a picture of you on a different day.
No, that was not me.
It just simply
facial structure doesn't look the same as mine. Nothing.
Yeah.
It's not even me. I mean, even everybody I've showed that knows me is like, that's not fucking you, dude.
Yeah.
I've had people text me like, this guy's saying it's you. That's not you.
Yeah.
So I mean, if that's what he's got, that's what he's got. That's not me.
Right.
What his intention with this is, I don't know. But they're
I mean, you guys have a history. I mean,
he doesn't like me flat out, and the feeling's mutual. But the thing is, I got with what I'm dealing with in my life,
right.
And that's all I'm focused on.
Right.
I'm not making money off of this stuff. This doesn't get me anywhere financially.
Right.
What it does provide is understanding and stuff that I wish I never learned. But the truth had to be known, and I'm thankful at least these insiders were able to show details and share me details as well of what they were personally dealing with, because these guys are working in that organization.
Yeah, so let's fast forward to that, kind of modern day, after your whole experience. You don't talk about this for many years. What motivated you to come forward? And because you signed an NDA that basically threatened your life and
correct
prison.
And all of us did sign that.
So what motivated you to come forward? What was your objective?
Well, I just think the truth should have been out. I don't think that this should be secret, and I don't think people should be dying and being threatened about ETs or craft or anything. It just sounds ridiculous to me. So my motivation was, you know what? Somebody else out there besides the guys I was with and myself have had to have similar experiences. And maybe there's a chance in hell that mine connects the dots for something. Maybe my story can help other people to an extent. As crazy as it sounds, and don't get me wrong, I agree that it absolutely sounds fucking nuts. But they're not in my shoes, and I wish some people were, because I'd be like, you guys would just shut up. You guys would stay quiet, and you guys were like, yeah, that's not cool to talk about. I don't enjoy talking about it. But that was kind of my intention, was maybe that this could help paint a picture or contribute in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there were whistleblower protections that had recently been passed.
Yes.
And I think I remember you talking about that kind of being part of your motivation. Like,
yeah,
that was the
now
time.
That they have a safety net to an extent, making the NDA illegal, you know, so obviously I haven't had any ramifications of that.
Yeah.
Because it's not like, I mean, I've had harassment, but, you know, and the harassment serves as more of like, okay, well, obviously I'm pissing the right people off.
Right.
You know, so if I, again, I have documentation of all the harassment that I've talked to with multiple people who know what's going on. If I was making any of this up, there wouldn't be this harassment. There wouldn't be these insiders. There wouldn't be this. I wouldn't have a leg to stand on with other facts. Now, if there are facts in my world. To somebody else observing outside of my circle, they may say, okay, in their world, it may not be facts. But for me, in my world, it is.
When I first connected with you, after my initial Reddit post, kind of just researching the military side of the operation and like realizing that, you know, everything you said to a letter was accurate.
Yes.
Regarding the kind of surrounding circumstances. And I was like, okay, well, what's next? You know? And so I reached out, we connected. If I'm honest, I actually grew more skeptical.
Yep.
As
you should
talking,
have. Anybody, yes.
Because you all of a sudden started talking about this insider, mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is weird. Like, yeah, what are
the chances
that you would have this experience, and now all of a sudden someone telling you that they know what you saw and they want to meet with you?
So, you know, I didn't have anybody else that I was talking to with this. I don't have a lot of friends. I don't care to have a lot of friends. I got a lot of acquaintances. I got a lot of people who know who I am to an extent. My world is just business, and that's what I separate this from business, because business is what my livelihood and my employees are. That's what I care about, as well as the disclosure of wanting the truth to come out. So it's not like I had anybody else to say, hey, and then when I saw what you were doing, and I saw the attention to detail and everything that you were piecing together, that kind of put something in my mind to say, you know what, maybe this guy can help me out to an extent. Maybe there's things that he could probably pinpoint or connect the dots on. And just your attention to detail was just something that's like, you know what, this guy's got his shit together. Maybe I'm able to provide information to you that, because you seem like you're well-versed in this. I'm not. I know what I experienced, and there's other things I'm now learning, especially with your guys' help, especially pointing out to me things that I can pass on to other people and say, yay or nay, does this have any legitimacy to it? So,
I was surprised at the amount of trust that you kind of put into me right away. Because, like, if you had like, told stuff to the wrong person.
You could have been, but I had a good chance of reading you and kind of gauging you, which is why we had a phone call that we initially had.
And the biggest, the most craziest, biggest moment for me was, you know, you were talking about this insider who wanted to meet with you. I was so skeptical. It sounded so crazy, but like I had nothing to lose. It wasn't like I was this podcaster who like had to report on the story. Like I could back away from the whole thing if it fell apart and I felt sketchy about it. But I was like, you know what? Let's just see what happens. We had a phone call the day before. I recorded that without your knowledge, and I.
I was freaked out.
You were freaked out.
I was freaked the fuck out. Yeah. I was, you know, because these guys could have done anything. I was going to their backyard.
I wanted to scream at you and like say, dude, don't go.
I know, but I had to learn the truth, and that's what they were offering. They weren't offering money. They weren't offering anything like that. They were offering a chance to set me and set the record straight of what I witnessed. And I think after keeping this, you know, quiet for 14 plus years, I think I deserve the truth. I think everybody deserves the truth, because for what's going on is absolute bullshit of why it's secret and why these guys feel in the right mind that they want to kidnap people or offer them a way out of their situation and use them as biological equipment in these programs is just, it doesn't sit well with me. I understand why, but I think if there was some kind of government intervention with this, that there maybe could people that want to volunteer and maybe see what they can do. And if they can, that's their thing. And I understand that these guys are also doing the same thing, but I think they're given false promises. I think they're being misled like they are, because that's why they're partaking in this, and they don't understand the magnitude of what they're doing. And from my current knowledge, I know that a lot of them don't know what they're getting involved with because they're heavily drugged and they can't recall what they're doing specifically with what they're making contact with.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this. So it was during the NPC you learned that these crates weren't trafficking drugs, but people.
So I did a 2-day event prior to that. Mm-hmm. It was June 10th, 11th, and 12th. Was it the 12th that the NPC was on?
Yeah, I think the Daily Mail article came out the 10th or 11th, and the NPC was out the 12th.
Because I was, I had talked to Josh Boswell with Daily Mail prior to going to DC. Mm-hmm. And Greer was the one that set all that up. And my goal, as much as I possibly can, is having some transparency, because I think that's important. And it is, as uncomfortable it is for me to be public, I don't enjoy it. But if I'm able to provide in any kind of asset to disclosure in any kind of way, I'm not here for money. Everybody knows that. I sleep good because I'm not for that cause. I make my own money, as you guys know. You guys have seen. So, and it's even crazy that I got employees that don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. And I don't talk about it freely. There's some people who do, and they're kind of curious.
Did they just like kind of find out on their own? Or?
Yeah. Other people. Oh, yeah. Some people talk. And like, yeah. So I assume that some people don't know because nobody asks me. Some people have seen what I did, and they're texting me, man, that's, you know, they kind of try to get in detail with it. And I'm like, I can't tell you much, man.
Yeah.
You know this, you know.
Yeah. Just jumping back to, I just wanted to emphasize that the biggest moment for me, and you actually, at this point, you're kind of like totally read into all of the evidence that I have.
Yes.
So like that meeting you had with the insider was the pivotal moment for me, because that conversation that you and I had prior to the day before that meeting gave me very specific starting point to be able to track the helicopter. I knew the location where you guys were meeting, and it set up a way for me to verify a lot of things. And
correct.
There was an important piece of evidence, and so that is what led me to
verify on your own accord.
To verify without you even knowing.
Correct.
Where you went.
I was really surprised when you told me after the fact. I was like, how the fuck did you find that? And then I was like, okay, now that it's obvious after that point.
Yeah.
I think it was a good slip up to an extent because it was able to at least pinpoint somebody to be able to verify. Because with that helicopter flight, you were, as well as I was, able to provide other events that were going on.
That was the other thing. Because like prior to me revealing to you that I like tracked it on radar,
I was like, hey, do you remember what time you took off and you told me? And it was exactly what the radar said. I was like, holy crap. And then,
yeah, there were some kind of limited time kind of events that were happening on the ground that could be visible from the air.
Yep.
And you corroborated that.
Yes.
I was able to cross check that with, local news. And like I've spoken to you about how I authenticated the evidence and used,
And the only thing I can say without going into specifics is, you know, where I went.
Yeah.
And that's all we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know, you know, now because he's provided, and I've okayed that because I think some people should know. I trust you guys.
Yeah.
You've been by my side for a year without finally meeting you today.
Yeah.
It's just still crazy.
Yes. But I can tell because I read people very well. That's where sales comes into. I can kind of gauge, and I know that you're for the truth, and I know you are too. And I am as well. And we're all in the same shoes as far as wanting this to come forward and wanting this whole thing to stop because our way of life can improve.
You know, the insider provided a lot of information for you to disseminate.
Yes. And granted, it was tough for me because they were in attendance, and it was a group of they, not pronouns.
Attendance in the NPC 2023?
They were there, but they were also there at the other events.
The one 3 days before.
It was
two days.
So it was a 10th, 11th, and 12th.
Okay.
So it was during... Was that on a Monday, the NPC? Let me look real quick.
Okay. Yeah. So you were talking about just a couple days before the NPC, that's when you first kind of met these insiders?
So I didn't meet them directly, but I know that they were in attendance. And when I had presented on that Saturday, I believe is when it was, Saturday and Sunday. I think it was a Saturday and Sunday because I got in Friday afternoon or morning, and then they went to the hotel. I had dinner with Greer, and everybody kind of met them. Well, actually, it was a couple drinks at the hotel, and then we got our rooms, got everything situated, went downstairs. I introduced my wife to everybody, too, that I've already been kind of somewhat familiar with and talking to, and it was my first time of meeting some people like Michael Stratton in person, Dr. Greer in person. Well, no, it'd be the second time because he was here in Boulder. That's when I first actually met him, and that was in 2017. And I just kind of felt that he was somebody at the time who was talking about this, and there were some things that he had hinted that maybe other people have experienced what I've experienced that he was talking to. So I wanted to tell him, hey, this was my situation. Do you know anybody else who went through this? Maybe it's something I can convey and compare notes to this person. And of course, some of them are dead and some of them refuse to talk, understandably. But yes, these insiders were there. So when I did that event, and it may be on YouTube, I can't find it anywhere. It may be on YouTube or some, because I know it was recorded because Dr. Greer and myself were kind of frustrated that their audio and video people were kind of slacking.
Mm-hmm.
I had given my piece that day, and I had expressed that what I hypothesized was drugs. Right. And that's when Dr. Greer pulled me aside and showed me his phone that had a text message from this individual that he had this encrypted app. It was not Signal, it was some other high tech communication platform. Did not look like Signal. And I read the text message. And what that text message said was, and my wife was actually sitting on the couch in the green room, and I was close to her, and Dr. Greer was standing to my right. And the text message said, I don't want to leave Michael hanging, but I know what Michael saw. And he went through this whole, he wrote a Bible, essentially, of what it was to an extent. But he had talked that he wanted to now talk to Dr. Greer privately and discuss what it was. And so I, at that point, because I was volunteered security for him, which is what I'm doing with this too, but it's more of me to kind of see what the fuck else is going on. That's just how I can get information. So you help benefit somebody, but you also get to kind of learn more in depth with what's kind of being going on, and you get to be in the sensitive meetings and stuff and kind of really see. So it's kind of my personal way to kind of disseminate information and maybe be able to understand. That's just my curiosity. But I met that gentleman, which of course he didn't know that I knew who he was to an extent, because Greer said he was going to meet with him and maybe they were going to put me in a green room and have a face-to-face conversation, which never happened. And then I wake up to a text message that he sent me at 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't remember what day specific. I still have it because I have it all saved, of course, just in case. I have a paper trail just in case anything happens. And he had said that a gentleman's name, to an extent, knows what I saw and would like to talk to me about it. And he is the NOC, non-official covers what that stands for in the CIA term. And he gave me his phone number, which is one of many, at least that number. So I was like, oh shit, okay. And it wasn't like I wasn't expecting it, because I was like, okay, this guy probably, he probably won't bother with me. He'll just tell Dr. Greer everything, and then Dr. Greer will tell me what I dealt with and experienced. But that wasn't the case. So I sat on it for probably about a day or two. Because I was like, okay, here's a point of no return, realistically. And then I was like, you know what? Fuck it.
So you're referring to he wanted to meet with you. Like, well, what was the message
he sat on? So the message I sat on was Dr. Greer providing me his contact information.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's what I sat on. And so I was just thinking every scenario in my head, like, oh, fuck, what is this doing? Am I getting set up? Was part of that too. I mean, it's a percentage.
Sure.
Because I'm nervous. You know, I've already kind of said my piece. I'm nervous. Now the whole world knows what I disclosed, and it was very uncomfortable. I hate fucking being public, but it's just, it's something that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And he had, I called him and he did not answer and he did not have a voicemail set. So then I texted him and he responded immediately. And I have the text messages, and basically what he said, he was going to fly me out somewhere and he was going to be able to provide me documentation among other things that will help me with this. But now that I came forward, these guys were working in that organization that I witnessed doing this operation. He had some insight to tell me, and that's what we did. We met up and you had the phone call of that.
Yeah.
And you have some details about where I met this gentleman particularly. And where he flew me off to provide me more information.
Now, why do you feel like he wanted to meet you in person versus just talking to you on the phone, or a video call, that sort of thing? Like, what was that?
I think it was establishing trust. It's easy to talk to people over the phone. Getting face-to-face with people and having them tell you things. Now, granted, when him and I met, and we were sitting across from each other, and I've said this in multiple interviews, but I had my phone off because he had this one that can detect any chips, and I showed you the text message or the message that he sent me talking about why they did that, and which they're all chipped. So that's all I'm going to say about that. But I guess it was a chance to get the truth, and I can tell when he was talking to me that he was very fidgety and very nervous because he doesn't know who I am, and I don't know who he is. So him being nervous... But he looked through my background. He looked at every possible detail about me. So he knew everything. So I know that he knew that wasn't some asset planted in trying to fish people out, which I know is a concern of theirs, which is why they're screening people heavily and do what they do. So, which I was just as nervous. And that's when he, during that interview or meetup, that meeting, that's when he provided me a sidearm. As a way to establish trust. And I looked at the bullets, and there were no struck primers, nothing like that. Popped it in, racked it, put it on my lap like this, and nobody else was armed. At that point, I kind of started getting to know him a little bit personally, some personal details about who he is and what he does and, you know, other things. You know, he's got a family, which is great because it tells me he's on the right side of things and he's loves his family very much, as you should. And that kind of gave me hope that, okay, this guy actually is taking that into consideration, which tells me everything. And his body language was also what conveyed it to me, too, because he was very fidgety with his watch. He's kind of like trying to adjust himself, and it's like, okay, I know you're telling the truth, because this is making you uncomfortable as much as it is making me.
And there was also sort of an apology that he gave
yes,
to you.
He did.
Can you talk about that a little
bit? He apologized on saying that he's sorry that we went through that, that it's absolutely unnecessary and it's bullshit, and that shouldn't be happening to anybody. And he knows of instances where they, yes, they have murdered people, not him directly, but he will never kill a patriot. He will never kill innocent people. But that guy will murder and kill bad guys, as it should be, because he's like a sheepdog. And all of these guys that I'm working with are the same way. They're all good people. And some people have had confusion to say, oh, we're held at gunpoint with these guys, and all of a sudden they're welcoming me in and giving me this knowledge and trust. No, it's not the same people. These are the good guys.
These guys weren't involved with the operation you witnessed in 2009?
No, they were not.
But they are aware of those types of operations?
Yes, and they've been on similar operations as that, to my understanding.
And so he showed you some things.
Yes.
You've said you went underground.
I can't talk about any of this.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you what you saw. What I want to ask you is, why did he show you that? In the sense of
What you could ask is what the things that he has been able to show you or prove. It was a way of him able to prove who he said who he really was.
That's exactly what
yes.
I was.
It wasn't like I can just take his word and just say, okay, I trust you.
Yeah.
It was a way for them to say, these are the real deal guys.
Right.
Because it's not like anybody can just see this shit.
Right.
And I hope one day I can get to a point where I can talk about that.
Yeah.
And because it is mind-blowing. And I thought what I witnessed in 14, 15 years ago was mind-blowing. Yes, it is. But now you actually see things face-to-face of what.
Yeah.
You know, because I'll put it this way. That facility, if these guys were to link up with two politicians and then give them a free access card to everything, it would single-handedly blow the doors off of this whole chicanery of misinformation and all the lies and all the deceit that are being there. This would prove everything. Because
what's stopping that from happening?
They're doing that right now, but they're trying to plan it out.
Okay.
In what way, I don't know, but that's what their goal is.
Okay.
And I can't give any details about that being mic'd up and all this, but I can tell you otherwise. But they're upset. A lot of them are upset.
I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is like, what's their objective with this? Like,
they want,
with reaching out to you and forming this partnership or relationship with you, what is their ultimate motive? Because these are people who are firsthand participants in the program.
Yes, for 30 plus years.
Yeah, and so they're pro-disclosure to
yes.
a certain extent.
Pro-American, pro-freedom, pro-life. You know, obviously they don't like that people are being murdered over this kind of stuff.
So there's kind of factions within.
Yes, that's exactly.
What people call the program.
Yes.
And these are kind of considered the good guys.
Yes.
Who want to support some level of disclosure and restoring oversight
yes.
by Congress.
So the other reason is that these guys were somewhat tasked to try to go through us or infiltrate, right? I think what would have happened is these guys would have been whistleblowers or considered whistleblowers themselves, not in a public fashion like I'm doing or anybody else that's in my shoes. But I think what happened was, now that I came forward, and what I experienced is directly related and directly involved with what they've been doing, it was more of a chance for them to say, okay, we can lay low, but now we have a spokesperson for us that can get this information out and tell and help us get information out to the right people. And I was successful and able to do that. But I was also successful and able to get them in contact with certain other prominent people.
Do these guys, these insiders, have any fear of coming forward? I personally have talked to some whistleblowers who are allegedly afraid to speak because they will lose pension. They will basically, they and their family will not have a way to provide.
Yes, they will lose everything.
Okay.
If this is not done correctly and carefully.
Okay.
And I don't know if these guys are coming forward. I can't specifically say that. I don't know. I just, Maybe one day they will. Who knows?
Well, but what do you think needs to happen? Or, you know, if you can convey kind of what guys have said, what needs to happen or change in order for more firsthand participants like them to be able to come forward? Like, what needs to happen?
The tables need to flip as far as the majority of these people in these programs are good people. And that's what I've from my own interactions with some of these people, granted I'm not working with everybody, right? But the ones that I know very well now, they're good people. They got their heart in the right place and they got the right mindset for this. What would need to happen is that the tables need to turn as far as them flipping the tables on their own programs, meaning taking control of them personally, getting the bad guys or neutralizing that, however, because what people need to understand is that this group is the enforcement arm of even the political corruption that's going on, because they have assets in certain places in government, local law enforcement, federal law enforcement, military, everywhere. So if they are able to single-handedly take the bad guys out or flip the script or gain control of that, because right now there's a war between the good and bad of these factions. Bad guys want to keep this secret and they want to keep this technology to themselves and they want to commit crimes against humanity with this technology and have this power and control, while the good guys want this to come forward and everybody benefit from it and us as a species be able to survive. Also, the fact that they know directly what is going on because they're living in this world. This is their day-to-day job, so to speak. So I think now that they have an opportunity to understand that this is affecting other people besides me, it's affecting all of us, because we could really be far in life with this technology. And not only that, we could stop shooting down NHI craft, because who's to say, I've never met any of them. I don't know any ETs or NHI. Never came face to face with them. What I can tell you is that I know that the universe is massive and there's multidimensional universes, or however this works with the theories that people have proposed. And if that really is the case, the possibility that we can come across a species that ain't going to be too friendly with us is a possibility. So you're telling, and this is what the concept is. So this group is going to target them, shoot them down in the deserts, all over the world, in secluded areas, and they are going to come across at a point maybe someday that they're going to shoot down the wrong type. And maybe that type becomes a type that decides that, hey, you know what? We don't need these people around. We don't need this species around. And they decide that we as people who don't even partake in that nonsense have to pay for it, meaning that our lives end as they can instantly do it if they wanted to, with what I have been told and what I've understand how powerful they are, if they're able to travel interdimensionally and through time and space and be able to show up here and go to any other place that they want to go and be able to control craft through consciousness and be able to pretty much, the way that they even said that, and this is just speculation, of course, because I've never seen this personally, but the way that they are actually able to go through things, be interdimensional, so can be in 3D or just have the image of, but they can also pass through solid objects like it's almost them, their molecules or atoms splitting between all of those to separate them somehow. So that's just speculation, but that's what I've been told. And so if you have something that advanced and some very smart that can end our lives, this whole planet if they wanted to, and for some reason they choose not to, but yet we keep shooting them down. And I mean us as a human species.
Right. So you described kind of the next step forward is for the good guys to kind of flip the tables on the bad guys.
Yes.
But what about the whole side of like legislation? I mean, is that still an important factor?
That allows certain things to happen to where there's involvement from both sides. Because there's laws that have to be abided by. There has to be military involvement to an extent, and there's also has to be a law enforcement effort, because essentially there's a lot of laws being broken with all of these, and that's kind of the thing that maybe they can get them on a technicality to get some laws passed that now all of a sudden these guys can't hide within that, because now there's proof that there's stuff going on that to law enforcement, like U.S. Marshals, for example, because they have jurisdiction everywhere, can be the ones to execute whatever they need to, right? That's just technically speaking.
And what about, like, how can we get more people like the insiders you're working with to come forward? Are there, you know, there seems to be kind of a, like, yeah, we have whistleblower protection, but it's really not enough.
It's really not enough, and that's exactly their concern.
Yeah, so what do they think needs to be done from that aspect?
Well, these politicians need to get their shit together, and they can't be corrupt, and like we're seeing with the whole pushback of the eminent domain and all that kind of stuff, because these aerospace companies are paying some of these guys. So, of course, hey, we'll throw you X amount of money if you play ball for us and make it to where it's hard for them to accomplish what they want, because then all of a sudden the game's up. Mm-hmm. These aerospace companies know what's going on. They're going to pretend that they don't, but they have access to this shit. And it may not even be the executives of these companies who know what's going on, but the contractors and the people that are within these groups know exactly what's going on and have access to it. And it's relatively a small number. It's not like every single Boeing personnel or Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or Northrop Grumman, for that matter, would have. Every single person knows what's going on. They don't. Only certain groups in that do.
And to touch quickly on what you were talking about shooting down these craft, are you aware of if in the program with these insiders, if there's kind of an ethical tug of war going on that?
100%.
Okay.
And that's kind of why they feel the need to want to divulge information to me, to spread it to you guys and to the world for that matter. The other aspect of it too is over these installations that civilian aircraft are being targeted as well when they're flying into these temporary flight restricted areas or TFRs. Innocent people, they go for a flight, want to go see some scenic views of some of these areas that are beautiful nearby, but happen to stumble into the area, just like we did, at the wrong point of time, and now they get hit with these experimental weapons. Well, you can't even call them experimental because they're using them. They're not known, you know, they're relatively, officially. Yeah.
Are you aware of what these offensive UAP weapons are, how
yes.
they work?
I can't give specifics to it, because a lot of them, I only know of a few. But as far as the other ones that are more cutting edge, because, like, again, they keep refining their systems because they want to make sure that they can just take them out with a single hit and have an easier time doing it, I would suppose. You know, that's just speculation, but they're always refining their stuff. They're always refining their reverse engineer technologies as well, which is why they test these weapon systems on them. So they had explained that they put craft on balloons, have them go up to high altitude, and then they hit them with these weapons because there's nobody aboard, right? And then they also have them stationary on the ground, and they can hit them at different angles to make sure that it's... But what they have explained to me was that they're EMP proof, what they have. They're not vulnerable to any kind of modern day munitions like rifle bullets or 50 cal machine gun ammo or ammunition or rounds. Missiles can't penetrate through their
You're talking about UAP?
That they have, yes.
Okay. They meaning?
They, as in these groups. If they really
that
want...
That they've retrieved?
Well, that they've designed and made.
Oh,
and they
okay.
reverse engineered,
so,
yes.
So like the ARV reverse engineered?
Yes, most of the ones that are coming out, and this is what some of the insiders had said, they are having a very hard time distinguishing the real craft from NHI compared to the ones that they've got. That's how far they've came. With this technology, they can't identify one from the other. It's getting to that point.
So it's practically been a year since, like, almost to like within a week since
yes.
you came forward.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What's next for you? And like, has your motivation for coming forward now changed? Like, has your objective now changed now that you've met with the insider and kind of gotten involved?
Yes.
That
yes, it has, because I feel like I can now help these guys in any way that I possibly can. I've been doing that behind the scenes, and it's good. It feels good to do that, and it feels good to be on the right side of history with this. And when everything does come to a head, hopefully there can be some positive movements that blow this all wide open, and we can all benefit. We could all be better people at the end of the day. That's what I want. That's my mission. The other aspect is obviously being provided the information that people are being taken and used in these programs. That doesn't sit well with me. When I heard that, I couldn't sleep for a week. There's many times where I've hidden in the bathroom and literally busted out fucking crying, because it's like, I couldn't do anything to stop that at that time. which sucks to know that. You're completely helpless. So I feel like it's my mission to get the right oversight to an extent. And maybe there can be things that can happen on a global scale that get these programs to be known programs. Maybe the right ways can be done with these, where people don't have to be sedated, people don't have to be treated as if they're biological equipment or pink assets, as they call them, that they can actually have people gain a foothold and do this peacefully and make us all better people. And everybody can live happily, everybody can live evolved. We can stop paying utilities because free energy will be a thing. Maybe I got fast cars, but maybe I can get some faster shit that I can drive around or fly around in, for that matter, however that comes about. But, you know, I think with optimism is that our world can be significantly better. But we have to go through some very hard times for this to happen. I don't have children, but I know you do. And I know that your children do benefit from having a better world that they can grow up and experience and not have to go through the corruption and see what we're dealing with as people right now who understand what's going on. And I know these insiders' families also deserve the same. You know, like I said, I don't want any money from this. All I want is for this to come forward, and all I want is this world to get better and change. That's my mission. Awesome. And, you know, anybody who has any problems with me not accepting money, tough shit. I make my own money. I'm not bought and paid for like most of these people who try to keep this shit hidden or secret or threaten them. They can threaten me all they want, but all it's doing is pissing us off and get us pissed off enough when we actually do something that actually, because here's the problem. As much as I would like to say, or believe me, everybody, because what I'm saying can be verified to an extent, which I choose not to because of keeping people safe in the process, as you guys know. But be skeptical, because there are people coming forward who should not be, or they're muddying the waters to an extent, and they're very known people. I don't get in drama of this shit. I don't care to. I've got my direction of where I'm going, and that's what I'm focused on. I let other people gossip and talk while I'm just focused. So that's what they can do. People need to understand that, yes, as much as I want people to believe what I'm saying, but at the end of the day, disclosure is about evidence. It's not about testimony. It's not about what I say. If I had proof.
So you think evidence is coming at some point?
Very much so. Yeah. How it will happen, I have no idea. Yeah. But I hope it does, and I hope it comes full force, because then it's going to kind of catch a lot of people with their pants down, people who pretend in the government that they don't know what's going on, but they fully well do, because they're getting paid from it under the table.
Right.
So it's going to be interesting how, oh yeah, you didn't know that this existed, but here's some documentation or some people who are saying that you were being paid for it, but yet they got this material or whatever it is that they have that's actually out. And now people know for a fact, oh shit, NHI or ET exists, guys. And we've had access to this, and we've been in communication to an extent for a very long time.
And I just got to ask two quick closing questions, if you don't mind. I think it was on the Total Disclosure podcast, you talked about that you had been in contact with David Grush. Can you comment on that?
I've talked to him, and that's all I can say.
Okay. And two, this is just kind of a personal one, because I've seen this bounced around a lot. I have seen many people call you Joey and Joey your publicist. You two are not the same person. And Joey, are you Michael's publicist?
Not at all.
Are you anything other than a private citizen who's investigating Michael's
just
case?
Just a random guy.
Are you paid for by Michael?
No. Oh, man. Yeah.
I know. I can imagine that's the skepticism.
It's, you know,
going
it's, like, it's just like, you know, Reddit. Most people are just anonymous on Reddit.
Yep.
And I just remained anonymous. Well, and now, you know, I'm showing my face now for the first time, and just trying to crack that open a little bit. And,
yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, there'll be a right time where everything can be divulged, yeah, and everybody can sleep better, you know. But I just saw what you were doing on Reddit, and it's like, you know what? You're a very good person to get information out. I don't know anybody else. Yeah. And thanks to you, you've been able to link me up with people who
that's
have.
That's true,
who,
too, yeah.
Yeah, you're very good at networking, too, and that's part of the reason why I'm successful. Is because networking is key. And that's, I use the same approach with disclosure. So if I'm in touch with people who are pivotal with this movement, then I'm able to contribute in ways that I possibly can to bring this forward to an extent, or however far we can get. And you introduced me to him, you know, which is great because you guys are wonderful guys, very good people, you know. So it's good talking to you guys and just even shooting the shit when we're not talking about this right. kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, so
I can't believe we're sitting here. This is
I know.
It's been a long time coming.
It's been a long time. Yeah. I'm like, you know, if I had time to go out there, I'd definitely go out there and see where, you know, what your part of the world is like. And
yeah.
See what you do day to day, and you get to
experience. Well, you certainly keep busy with everything you got.
Yeah, I'm surprised I'm not completely bald yet, but it's getting there. But I got some hymns I'm trying, so hopefully that helps. But you know, if not, then I'm just gonna be another whistleblower that's bald.
Yeah, dude, yeah. Rock it.
Well, this was awesome. I, you know, so grateful that you sat down with us, and excited to kind of see how things unfold moving forward. So,
well, I from what I kind of understand, it may be pivotal to a point where we get the grip on the right way and it comes forward and everybody understands. It doesn't have to be secret anymore.